Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Code and the Coding Coders Who Code It. I'm your host, Drew Bragg, and I'm joined today by Andrew Atkinson. Andrew, for those who are unfamiliar with you and your work, could you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, yeah. Thank you for having me. My name is Andrew. I also go by Andy, and I'm a software engineer. Mostly, I have worked with Ruby on Rails, and the last couple of years, I have worked with Postgres as more of a specialization for my career area. So now I kind of call myself a software engineer with a database or a Postgres specialization. And outside of that, I got a couple of kids and yeah, I'm currently working for a company called Fountain, which is a B2B SaaS application. And it provides companies the ability to do their hiring process through the platform. So companies that have needs where they hire in high volume, so it could be all across the country, and they hire hourly workers, they might choose Fountain for their hiring solution. And so I help build and support that product and platform at the company.
Awesome. And you're writing a book.
I am. Yes. I'd love to tell you more about it, but briefly, where things are at right now is I signed a contract to write a book about a year and a half ago and been writing for about a little more than a year, with the last 6 months being a little more intensive on the editing phase. But where things are at right now is actually at the end of this month, very exciting, the beta release is planned. So it's going to be, the book is going to be called High Performance Postgres for Rails. And it's going to hopefully help Rails and Ruby developers that might use Postgres, but use it in a basic way, kind of level up. That's the goal. So it's jam-packed with examples and exercises, and everything's open source and free. And the idea is that going through the book, reading the chapters, working on the exercises, you'll kind of gradually build up hopefully new skills that you can bring into your job. So I'm very excited about the book releasing soon.
Yeah, that's awesome. I am also excited. I recently changed jobs and I went from MySQL to Postgres. So I am excited to get to work with it, but I would definitely put myself in that category of use it in a very basic way. I know there's a couple of fancy columns, but then there's a lot more to it than just a couple of fancy columns that Postgres can do for you. So I'm excited for a book like that for someone without a heavy database background. I'm a Rails developer, so in my language would be the best way to learn more about the advanced features. So before we get into it, for anyone new to the show, the way this is going to work is I'm going to ask Andrew three questions. I'm going to ask him what he's working on. I think we might know what he's going to talk about there. What kind of blockers he has. And if he doesn't have a current blocker, he can talk about a recent blocker he had and how he went about solving it. And then I'm going to ask him what's something cool, new, or interesting that he's recently learned, discovered, built. It doesn't have to be coding related, but it absolutely can be. And of course, all of the questions can relate to your work life, your personal life, your writing of the book, becoming an author, things of that nature. So without any further ado, Andrew, what are you working on?
I am doing a lot of writing.
I'm doing a lot of editing. I saw that coming for some reason.
It turns out that editing is kind of a way to just say you're rewriting something usually. So basically this latter stage of the book process for me has been, the first draft of the book was written back in around the holiday time at the beginning of the year. And that was a big milestone. It felt like at the time there was a sense of being done, but of course I was not done at all. The first draft is a good milestone, but really to improve the quality of the chapter, make it more cohesive, make things sequenced in the right way so they're not jumping out of order. The reader is learning new terminology. It kind of requires, for me anyways, like a front to back rewrite of the chapter. So I go through, and that's what I've been doing a lot lately. And recently, actually, I finished all of the chapters with that first pass. So the publisher has a beta release concept. And that will be, as I mentioned, that will be later this month. And the idea is that the book isn't really fully done at that point, but it will be available for purchase in the PDF form. But there's still going to likely be more of this editing process, right? So there'll be some people reading it, hopefully, and then they'll be saying, oh, this isn't clear, or this part's wrong, or whatever. And probably it'll be more of the same. We'll continue to refine it. But yeah, I mean, it's a fulfilling process that I expect to be even more fulfilling once it really gets out there and folks are able to provide even more feedback.
Sure. So you're basically kind of in the mode of refactoring prose right now.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to put it. And there are a lot of similarities to writing code. And part of what attracted me to Pragmatic Programmers, which is the publisher of the book, is there, actually, let's talk about it because I know you have a Ruby background as well. So I was very excited to and honored to have a proposal with Pragmatic Programmers accepted because I think of them as the publisher for Ruby books and Ruby on Rails books. And the reason I think that is because those are all the books that I bought 10 years ago or whatever when I was getting into Ruby, getting into Rails. Yeah. And Drew's kind of pointing to his collection behind him.
Yeah, I also got my bookshelf.
Random books all over.
Yeah.
So it's really flattering that, but it also feels like a big responsibility to not fumble this and do a good job and make sure that it's going to meet the standard that the publisher has set, I think, with their book quality. The tangent I went off on was the brand cachet or the whatever, the Ruby on Rails kind of legacy and roots of the publisher based on the founders being Ruby enthusiasts and writing one of the early books being the Ruby Pickaxe book. So there's that legacy and DNA in the publisher. But on a practical level, regarding your refactoring point, we're not really writing unit tests, but there is actually kind of unit testing style in a sense to writing the book. Let me explain that. So what you do at first is with this publisher is they really focus a lot on each chapter having what they call a story map. And it's kind of an outline, but it's part of how the reader who is ideally is the central person that you're catering to as the writer, you're trying to help them solve their problems and learn something. So the story map is kind of their story as it unfolds in that chapter where they're going to have the opportunity to work on improving their skills around a problem that they're having. There's a big emphasis on that at the early stages of the book. So you write the story maps for the chapter and they actually go through a full review process and everything. And even without writing the chapter content. And then how does that relate to refactoring? Well, as we know, as programmers, we can improve the legibility or the readability of code. We can make it easier to make it more extensible. We can make it more reusable with refactoring without changing the functionality, right? We can make it more testable. Those are some of the things that we might do when we refactor code. With the chapters, there's a little bit of that too. As you do these revisions over and over, you kind of look back at the story map and you use it almost like a unit test in a sense where you say like, is this chapter accomplishing the goals of what I said it was going to accomplish? And what other people have agreed to with the scope of the chapter in the story map when it was reviewed earlier. So I actually do think it's a little bit like refactoring code. And it's like, it's kind of weirdly satisfying in the same way. Like with code, if your tests pass still, but you feel like this code is easier to maintain, this code is more extensible, it's documented better, whatever the things are that you're trying to achieve, it's satisfying. You feel like you, if it's very important code in the code base, like it relates to a feature that's high value, that's been around for a while. Like it feels good, like you did a good job.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a writer. Like I can't picture that in my head, but relating it to code, I can absolutely picture the number of times where I wrote something, all the tests pass. I'm like, this is technically good enough, but I'm going to refactor it and make it better. And that final bit of code is like, ah, this feels so good because it still works, it still passes, but it just, the next person who has to interact and read this code is going to be a lot happier. And for you, it's like, yeah, we write code that a computer has to understand, and then we also write it for other people. Like you are definitely writing for other people. So there's got to be a lot of satisfaction that comes out to like, ah, people are going to love this section. It's going to read so much better.
There are a lot of similarities to writing code with this kind of refactoring of the chapter content. By the way, we didn't plan to go into refactoring chapter content, but I feel like this is kind of interesting
to think about. Show.
So if we think about cohesion and coupling, and if people aren't familiar with those terms, like in a code base, like in a, let's say a Ruby class, it's cohesive. It has like a clear purpose and it doesn't do a million things. And it has low coupling, which is a good design goal. If it doesn't have loads and loads of dependencies on other classes within the code base, and that makes it easier to isolate and test and move around and that kind of thing. And actually writing chapters in a book, same sort of things are good. Like having the chapter be very cohesive, not be jumping around to lots of topics, have low coupling, right? Like, in fact, that's something I really learned in the process is I actually thought high coupling was good in writing, and the editor that I work with kept removing all of my, what I thought were awesome links all over the place. Like in this chapter, you'll learn this. In that chapter, you'll do that. In this chapter, like I wrote that probably like, I don't know, hundreds of those, and they just kept getting removed by the editor. And turns out the editor was right. Very experienced editor, Don, who I'm working with. As I came to learn it's not actually helpful to the reader to kind of constantly be redirecting them around. And it detracts from, again, the cohesiveness of the chapter, right? You're trying to learn particular topics and that kind of thing. So yeah, so I think that's another cool way to equate writing code and writing prose. Like you said, it's like, and this editing phase that I've been doing for a long time, that's really what it is. It's like the whole idea of the chapters is there and there's a bunch of words, but it's really like, can we make it more cohesive? Can we reduce the coupling? Can we clarify terms, sequence them appropriately? All these things that hopefully help make for a better chapter for readers.
And that's got to be an interesting challenge too, because I think at least for a Ruby book or a Rails book, there's a lot of building off of base skills. Now that we've learned this, we can get into the slightly more advanced topics. You need the stuff you learned in chapters 1, 2, and 3 for chapters 4, 5, and 6 to make sense. But because it's a technical book, you also want chapters 4, 5, and 6 to kind of be able to stand on their own. Like you want someone to be able to go, oh, I remember reading that, flip open a chapter 4, read a paragraph or two and be like, ah, yes, I know how to solve my problem. So that's got to be a unique challenge to have something that builds on itself, but is still so minimally coupled to everything else that it makes sense on its own.
It is, yeah. And I have other Postgres books that I read and have read, and I've tried to differentiate this book from those books. It's not intended to be an introduction to Postgres books. And so like, for example, database constraints. There's a whole chapter dedicated to the quality of your data and adding constraints to your tables, whether it's to define columns to make your database schema more expressive as to what you can expect in a column, to link tables together, those sorts of things. But I didn't want it to just be like a Postgres in isolation introduction to constraints, or even like a SQL, SQL constraints that could be basically the same, whether you're working with Postgres or MySQL or another standards-based relational database. So I tried to put a Ruby and Rails spin on it and flavor. So there's a connection to active record validations, for example. As Rails developers, we do a lot of expression of the data model in the model layer, right? We say has and belongs to, we describe what to do when records are destroyed. We have lifecycle callbacks, and there's a lot of overlap in purpose with database constraints. So I think there was an opportunity there to say like, you could pick up this chapter just if you're like, hey, I need to add some database constraints. Let me pull this up as somewhat of a reference. The book isn't really intended to be as much of a reference book. I think there are better reference books because that wasn't really the goal. The goal was to, I guess, explore topics and compare and contrast these kinds of approaches and to some extent not like create a exact opinion that the reader should take away, but have them explore these things and then arrive at their own conclusions. That would be my ultimate goal. I think that's my preferred kind of teaching style too, I guess, is, I don't know, you decide. Like, here's a bunch of options. Let's go through them.
I think that's a really good way of approaching teaching and should be the goal. Even if it's just a blog post and you're trying to introduce someone, like, I get so much more value out of the, like, here are the technical aspects and then, like, some of the impacts of these certain decisions. You yourself need to decide what is best for you and your code base and your specific situation, rather than saying like, this is bad, STI is bad across the board, never use single table inheritance, it's horrible, like,
yeah,
you're just going to run into issues. It's like, well, no, there's a reason why it exists. It's about educating and not telling people how to feel. I think that's hard to do for sure, especially when you're passionate about something. But I think that's an admirable goal to have for the book, to introduce topics and then let the reader come to some of their own conclusions.
Thanks. Yeah, I think the STI or single table inheritance example is a good one too. And actually, I know I had it in my notes at some point to go through and set up an explanation for that. And let's talk about that a little bit more too. So I also have, in addition to the challenge of writing the book, if you're writing a book about databases in an application, a client application, I don't know any other way to do it without having a database and a client application to work with. And initially I started off with these generic examples where I would always just have the reader create this table, insert these rows, but then it's kind of disconnected from an application, or you could generate a new Rails application, but you have a schema that you haven't defined at all. So I ended up actually repurposing an existing app that I have. Many years ago, I interviewed at a company and didn't get the job. In preparation for that, or possibly actually after the interview or both, I think I was like creating a Rails app, trying to bake in all of the best practices that I knew from different jobs and from my own experience learning. And these are all open source ideas. It wasn't like proprietary company ideas, but it was like for authentication, use Devise, or for like XYZ, use this gem or that kind of thing. Or maybe like code patterns, use this style of testing for this kind of problem. So I had made this app and I wanted to use something. And this was a number of years ago, so now it's even a little more passe, but I wanted a modern area for the app to be the domain model for. So I chose ride sharing, like Uber or Lyft, that kind of thing, as opposed to like e-commerce or other types of things that might be more common kind of learning or example applications.
So not a to-do list.
God. Not a to-do list. Yes, I have made many to-do lists.
Haven't we all?
To-do list is the hello world, I guess, 2.0. Yes. So yes, all of the to-do lists. I haven't made a to-do list in a while. What is that? Maybe I need to make another to-do list. I'm getting the itch, I guess. So yes, not a to-do list, something a little more interesting. Granted, I've never built a ride-sharing business from scratch, so it's kind of a guess at what things would, how I might model it. But that being said, you can actually download, and the book references this in one part. I think it's in the bulk uploading chapter. There's a section where I have readers work with a lot of the bulk capabilities, whether it be with Postgres or with Active Record or even like Ruby gems, like Active Record import. And it's really important in my career experience because it always comes up. It's like we have this CSV file we need to load, and you don't want to write like a row by row insert. You want to just bulk upload it quickly. It could be a million rows or something. And there's actually an Uber data set you can download that has trip data, and it's linked to in the book. I need to continually make sure that it continues to be available to download since there's content written for it. But in there, you can deduce some of the model of the domain too. Like, what are the columns called? It might be like a flattened data structure. It could be more of a normalized relational model with lots of tables and objects in behind the scenes that becomes denormalized and dumped into a CSV file. So anyway, the point of saying that was rideshare's domain model is kind of a guess, but it does line up a bit with the Uber data set. So the domain model has trips and trip requests and drivers and riders and that kind of thing. So let me go all the way back to the book now. So I had been developing this Rails app just as like a side fun project. And this is something else I also recommend to team members I work with too, is anytime I try to look at a new idea, like I see something cool on Hacker News or whether it's a new database or a Ruby gem or whatever, I always think it's a good idea to get some reps in and practice essentially with like a toy app. So build a toy app, install the database with Docker or something, like just get a little hands-on with it and try it out. And you can learn a lot just from that. And for me, I can feel much more confident making a recommendation either for or against something if I have some of that kind of hands-on experience. So the rideshare app was really just serving my purpose for that mostly. Like I would document things, but no one would really read it. And I didn't tell anyone about it or anything. And so as I was going in the book, it dawned on me at some point, maybe halfway through the book, I'm like, this rideshare app could have a new life as the base app that's used all throughout this book. Makes a lot of sense. And so I convinced myself anyways to do that. Again, going back to our refactoring discussion earlier, though, that did mean I needed to redo a lot of examples to be based on rideshare. And then I remember we started talking about single table inheritance. So in rideshare, I actually use single table inheritance. The drivers and the riders model are both users. So the database table is called users. And then there's a Ruby class or an Active Record class that for each of those other models, because riders and drivers share most of the same attributes. And that's one of the use cases for single table inheritance. You have one database table that you can use, and then you just store both records and you just have a type column, a string column. And actually, in the book, I think that as a databases book and a databases person, I would actually nudge people possibly away from single table inheritance. But I would like, per what we said earlier, I'd like them to understand what the purpose of STI is and what the benefits are. So they could say, okay, does this let me build this quicker and easier? And is it good enough? If so, that's fine. And I actually just ended up leaving rideshare with STI. Although if I was rebuilding it today, I wouldn't go that route. I would likely create separate tables and possibly even three tables to express this relationship. And then I would use foreign keys if I had distinct drivers and riders tables that had shared users attributes. I would link them together with constraints. That was an extremely overdone answer to talking about STI and letting readers arrive at their own decisions, but it is a good example. So I'm glad that you mentioned it.
Yeah, it was a topic not too long ago. So it was top of mind as soon as we started talking about various patterns. So admittedly, I have a little bit of knowledge about some of the blockers that come along with writing a book and even writing a book for Pragmatic, because I've had Noel Rappin, who is rewriting the Pickaxe book, on the show to talk about some of his adventures. So I'll be curious, what kind of blockers do you have writing this book?
I also have a full-time job and I also have a family. And the biggest blocker is just being disciplined about making time for it and trying to negotiate what can be a tricky challenge. My work can be very demanding too. I work for a startup company. We recently gained one of our most premier customers. I can't yet talk about their name, but the whole company, CEO included, very, very excited that we were able to land. But as any business that has a very important person or a VIP type of customer or client, you need to take care of them. It's an important new relationship you want to nurture. So work has been very demanding. And it's like a challenge to, while I think I have the time to make the kind of commitment that my employer expects from me as well, I also have a commitment to myself and to the publisher to keep chugging along with the book. And I also have a commitment in a sense to my family as well, to make sure that I'm like, you know, not,
yeah.
And I have a commitment to myself to manage my personal health. And to be honest with you, sometimes like in this process, some of those things at different times, they get bent a little bit and hopefully it's temporary. But with writing too, and as a programmer, I don't know how to get around this really, but you spend lots and lots of time sitting at a desk. And I think at this stage in my life, I need to really keep my personal health in mind and make sure that I get exercise in and get some movement in and all those kinds of things so that I can keep doing what I want to do, which is working and writing this book and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, physical health is important, but also mental health is important. That's a lot. I mean, I feel like just having a full-time job with a family is a lot all on its own. And then you add on what arguably is another job, is writing this book. Like, how do you manage all of those domains and not experience burnout? Or are you just flying by the seat of your pants is also completely reasonable.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And it's something maybe that's as exciting to talk about because it can be hard to talk about and still kind of keep a positive and upbeat vibe, I guess. But we're a very pro mental health household. My partner, my spouse, is actually a psychiatrist and is a big advocate of active mental health considerations and works with a patient population that is usually at a really hard point in their lives where they're struggling and stuff. So I've learned loads and loads from her. We've been married for more than a decade and I didn't really have a mental health background, but I've learned all kinds of things, whether it's therapy, whether it's journaling. The thing is, like, I'm not really great at any of them, but I have lots of techniques that I'll use in different situations. If I get really stressed, do know that even though it's really hard to do, I try to get some exercise in or some movement. If I have just a scramble of ideas going around in my head, I try to just start writing. Like, for me, that's a process to help organize my thoughts often, even if it's a note that I just write and throw away or something like that. And then I think really fully disengaging with the computer helps a lot too. It's summertime here in Minnesota where I live, so it's really nice outside. We get these 3 great months and then we suffer for 9 months. And then, you know, most weekends, laptop lid closes. You know, I have the privilege of having a dedicated basement office space here where I'm talking to you from, but I like really try to just get away from it. And the truth is like, I'm still on my phone and I'm checking Twitter and whatever, but I do try to really get away. And I think that's an important part of it, is making sure that you're still investing in your relationships, whether it's your family or your friends or that kind of thing in your life. And it's a lot to balance. So over the process, particularly writing the book, I did have to make an effort to cut out some things. So TV and movies, for example, it's like a fun, relaxing thing to do. But honestly, I barely have done any of it in a year. And my wife and I are like extremely scheduled with our time. So I have dedicated writing time once per week, but we have like, if we do a date night or something, it's like on the calendar. Every day of the week is planned out, basically. So I try to really maximize any time I have available. So that's a pretty truthful answer. That's a peek into my world.
No, it's good. I try not to shy away from questions like that because I think it's important to hear that we all, to varying degrees in our own worlds, deal with that kind of stuff. I mean, you're able to take on something like writing a book with everything else when everything else all on its own is enough for your brain and your mental health. So hearing various strategies, hearing that, like, hey, it's something that we all struggle with no matter where we are in our careers is, I think, at least for me, important. Not having that feeling of like, I am the only person that can't get work done. That's not true. We all struggle with it in various ways. And then there's, as you brought up, there's so many different ways of tackling and dealing with it that trying to find the thing that helps you the most is really just exploring yourself and being mindful of like, hey, journaling doesn't work for me because of X, Y, and Z reasons. So I'm going to try this other thing. Because for you, scheduling works great. Scheduling's trash for me. I can't schedule. I will blow that schedule out of the water and then my day will be ruined. But this is something that I had to learn because for a very long time, it was like, oh, just schedule everything and then it'll get done. It's like, turns out that doesn't work for me. But also, I don't have to feel bad about that because I'm not the only person that doesn't work for.
Right.
So I do like to, whenever possible, ask that kind of question of like, hey, how do you keep your mental health healthy?
Yeah.
But yeah, physical and mental health.
Yeah, physical and mental health.
Things.
Yes, definitely. And it is something that I think if you want to be in an engineering career on a sustainable basis, like I personally have never been one that I've cared a little too much about some of the things that are outside my control. So I'm always working on trying to improve and understanding, is this really within my control or my jurisdiction or not? And if it's not, like letting it go, that's such a great skill to have that I don't think I'm naturally blessed with, but I've tried to work on improving and being mindful of. Yeah. Regarding the scheduling, my spouse is completely, well, not completely, but at least when we were working on a project together recently, like a house project, and having a plan in advance and scheduling out steps took some of the joy away from her. And we had a really good conversation about how the project was kind of a fun project. It was a gardening one. And she didn't want her experience to be diminished by having it like over planned and scheduled. And something we didn't, even despite being married for like 10 years, I think it was a good learning moment where we kind of grasped, hey, we have different styles. So let's either kind of take turns or try to compromise. And to some extent, I think that also is happening all the time as I'm juggling these things with either my family or my employer or the publisher, is at sometimes I just need to stop one. So I might not, you know, over the last year, there were times where I wasn't writing for like a whole, you know, a week maybe, or I don't really believe in like multitasking. It's a concept that people say it's possible to kind of do multiple things at once. I just think you switch back and forth, and over time you get better at switching with having high context on things you're switching between. So it can appear as if you're multitasking, but really you're just kind of switching. And so that's a lot of what it is too. And I think over time I've learned ways to make switching in and reloading context into my brain quickly. One thing I learned a long time ago from Railscast back in the day from Ryan Bates. I don't know if you ever Railscast.
The man, the myth, the legend.
Yes. Yeah. I got to meet Ryan Bates at one Ruby event a long time ago and thanked him for Railscast. And that was a nice moment. Railscasts were online screencasts, maybe like Go Rails now, but they're not made anymore. But they were really good for folks learning Ruby on Rails 10 years ago. And I remember there was an episode at some point from Railscast. This always stuck out to me. And I remembered learning it from Ryan Bates, but he'd be working on a task, like writing a test for some code that he had just written. But he'd deliberately leave it unfinished, even if he knew what the answer was, what the goal was. So let's say it was an unfinished test, but it was like spec'd out, but you kind of knew what the assertion was you're going to write. You had the data set up or whatever the test was. He'd leave it unfinished. And the purpose was that when he'd leave and come back and sit down, he just knew exactly what to do and he'd get into it right away and he'd get some momentum going. And I thought that was a really good tip. And I found myself doing that. And even with writing too. I'll like plan out, I know I have an hour tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. or 8 a.m. or whatever. I'll have a plan in mind and I'm going to just blast out everything I know about this topic and I'll maybe write like a line or two or something, but I'll have the desire to just finish it and write it at that time, but it won't be a good time because of other things going on in my life. So it allows me to quickly get into it and try to maximize that time and not be blocked on wondering what I'm going to write about and stuff. But I think that's another similarity between coding and writing as well.
That's a good trick. I like that. I might have to steal that and start using it.
Yeah, try it out.
That would be definitely a very effective way to get back into the work quickly without trying to use energy that's at a premium anyway, trying to figure out where was I.
Yeah, that's a great word that I use as well that I learned from, and sorry to jump in here. Let me say one more quick thing. I learned from the staff engineer book was to really think about what kind of work you like to do that energizes you and kind of manage your energy. And part of being able to write this book is that, frankly, I love writing about it. It's selfishly, it allows me to go much deeper on topics than I would get to in my job or in my personal projects. And there's a responsibility there to like understand it well enough to teach it to someone else and to be able to describe what the trade-offs are. And you can't really just have a superficial understanding of the topic. Or I also learn what I don't know and what's kind of outside the scope of the book. So there's a selfish component there. But for me, it's a topic I'm passionate about. If I wasn't, I would be burned out big time. You know, it is like this kind of engine of curiosity and interest. And I try to use that. And at times over the last year, I strategically wrote topics that were related to what I was doing at work or related to things I wanted to explore, again, to kind of leverage that energy, you know, carry it into the writing.
And at least in my experience from a podcasting standpoint, if you're passionate about something, the content is that much better. When I have a guest on and we just start talking about like, oh, I need to talk about this. I say, what are you working on? It's like, oh, at work, this is what I'm working on. It's like, cool. I listen back to that episode and I'm just like, wow, that's a boring ass episode. It's yeah, it's not the guest's fault. I did a bad job guiding the conversation. But when folks come in and they are excited to tell me what they're working on, they're excited about a blocker they recently solved or something like that, it legitimately turns into a much better episode. And I suspect that translates into writing too. I think the book's going to be great because you are passionate about this and you are knowledgeable. I've seen you talk at conferences in the past and like the content is good and your knowledge is good. Your ability to translate a complex topic and just something digestible for like a dum-dum like me, like that's a great skill. So I think the book is going to benefit drastically from your passion.
Thank you. That was a string of many nice things you said. I appreciate it.
That's my prediction, at least.
Yeah, I think it's true as well. And again, like there really wasn't much, honestly, like even things like I'd say all of the content in the book is stuff that I'm really excited to talk about. And that's why I wrote about it. And there's probably some areas that are not covered. And it could be because I didn't think to cover them or they haven't. A big gauge as to whether or not it would be something in the book was, is this something I have experienced in my career as 15 years of doing software development, roughly? Have I seen this kind of thing before or not? Or is it a really esoteric kind of feature that it's like, I'm sure there's a use case for it, but it's not something I've seen. I tried to make that the main kind of is it in, is it out kind of topic, but it's also stuff that I'm excited about. And it's because like you said, hopefully it means that I just made sure to meet that responsibility of understanding the topic well enough to be able to present it in a way that's going to add value compared with just reading the documentation around it or just trying some basic experiments.
Yeah. And your audience are not DBAs, they're not database dedicated folks. They're Rails developers trying to get better skills for around the database, around Postgres, but essentially for their day-to-day. So going into those really deep things that the database can do, if it's not applicable to their job, it's probably not worth your time or their effort or your effort, their time.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. That's really on the, so I mean, we didn't really talk about the marketing side of the book and stuff, but really on the marketing side, you're trying to find, and the publisher gets to decide when you're working with a publisher, do we think we're going to sell more than one copy of this book to this author's mom or whatever? Like, I'm pretty sure my mom's good for one. I don't know. I haven't asked her yet, but she doesn't use Postgres or Ruby on Rails, and she's been retired for a long time, but she's one of my biggest fans, and which I appreciate. So what I hope for secretly, don't tell anyone this, which I'm joking around because I'm on a recorded podcast, but I hope the book is useful for people that are not just Ruby on Rails developers, because I really thought of the kind of book that I would love to write, but I don't really feel qualified yet to write, possibly someday, would be Postgres for web developers, really just straight up. But the thing is, like, to me, the book needed to have a lot of great examples and really bring in a whole ecosystem, which in the book it does. There's more than 40 Ruby gems and Postgres extensions, all open source, that are part of really an ecosystem for really getting things done, whether it's scaling or data loading or schema definition or queries or maintenance or whatever. And I didn't know how to do that with Python or Django or PHP or Laravel or Java or Go or some other kind of language and web framework, because I'm not really in those communities day to day. But I hope that it's useful for other web developers. I also hope it's useful for infrastructure engineers that I do work with some folks like that that want to go a little deeper on databases or learn a little more about the app side of things. And then I also hope the book is useful to database administrators that might work with teams of developers that might say, this is a pretty good book. I'm going to share this around in my team and maybe we can speak the same language. Maybe we'll do this thing in SQL instead of application code and we both can support it or we both are on board with this approach. So yeah, that's what I secretly hope for. But I think me saying that is different from some reader saying that. So I'm hoping that I'm just going to see how it goes. And after the book releases, like curious to see if that happens.
That is one of the beauties of using Ruby or Rails to illustrate concepts is it's so readable that you don't necessarily need too heavy of a background in it for the concepts to get across. I mean, that's, I suspect, one of the reasons why Sandy chose Ruby for practical object-oriented design patterns. She just happens to use Ruby to write her examples rather than Java and clean code. It's just, hey, I can write it in this example, and you can probably read and grasp these concepts. Practical object-oriented design patterns is not a book about Ruby. It's about design patterns for object-oriented programming. It just so happens that Ruby, it sounds like you're kind of hoping for the same effect where it's just the concepts in the book are good enough to stand on their own without it being tied to Ruby and Rails.
Yeah, I hope so. There's a lot to learn. If everyone magically knew Ruby on Rails, whether they worked with it or not, and we're reading the book, there's still a lot of things to learn about Postgres and SQL. We go into the procedural language that's built in. You can write SQL database functions. And then, of course, like a lot of the advanced indexing. And more people are talking about Postgres as more of a platform, which I think is really cool. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of functionality and the book goes into this. Like you can do publish and subscribe. You can do full text search, whether that's keyword-based searching or even the more recent vector similarity searching using vector embeddings from OpenAI's APIs, for example. I just snuck a section in on that in the section of the book where the reader builds up a full text search capability, all using what's built into Postgres and connecting it to a Ruby application using the PG search Ruby gem as well to make it a very nice and maintainable kind of Ruby scopes based search capabilities in your active record models, but generating this really gnarly wild SQL behind the scenes to do the searching. But I also have the reader like break down all the parts of the SQL query so they know what's happening in there as well. That's why I love Ruby and I love working with it and continue to try to work with it in my career is it's very readable. It's the most English-like way. There's a big emphasis on, you know, readability and comprehensibility and not as much on wild configuration and patterns that I might have seen in other ecosystems where it feels like there's a real explicit goal, whether from the language or even also in the Ruby on Rails framework, for understandability and bringing in team members and maintaining code that everyone kind of gets what it's doing or they can dive into it and figure out. So yeah, I hope that people that even if they don't work with Ruby day to day, they find value, but they do work with Postgres, for example, they would pick up this book and they'd be like, yeah, I can basically run these Ruby examples. I can boot a Rails console and type in this code and that kind of thing. And that would be great.
Awesome. I think it's a great goal to have. I do want to leave enough time though for my favorite question. What is something cool, new, or interesting that you've learned or discovered or built? You can't use the book as your answer.
I'm like, which chapter did I not highlight yet? My first thought in answering the question, because this is not a pre-canned answer, it's just all of the cool open source projects that I've learned about in working on the book, where some of them were genuinely new, but it's more like I was searching for a really good encapsulation of like a particular problem to solve and then a solution for it, or just kind of searching what are the most modern and approaches to solving this problem. So like the Rails N plus one query problem, like there's a bunch of different Ruby gems that try to detect N plus ones and give you solutions, but there's Ruby gem called, I've never heard anyone pronounce it, but I believe it's called pronounced Prosopite.
I know what you're talking about. Yep.
That's one that I felt like had baked the most concepts in to solving that problem, both like on the detection side and the solutioning side. And in really diving into that, the other thing too is there are so many things in Ruby on Rails that I didn't know about that I learned about just in trying to think about this. So let's talk about that example a bit more. So there's that Prosopite gem. And then one more thing, in Active Record, in I believe it was 6.1, which is fairly recent, they added a new functionality called strict loading. Have you worked with that?
Haven't, because my last job, I had gotten us right onto 6.1 and then I left.
Okay.
My long 2-year journey of upgrading ended at 6.1, and where I'm at now, we are on 7, but I'm still pretty heavily onboarding. So I haven't gotten to play it around with anything yet, but I do know what you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. So the N+1 query problem, really briefly, is if you're in a loop and you're doing repeated queries to the same table, typically you can eager load that table in your active record code by doing either includes or preload, and you can set up that relationship of that kind of foreign table or referred to table. And it will load the required records, whether it's one or multiple queries up front. And then you're not repeatedly querying and causing this kind of like excessive queries, which uses database connections and that kind of thing. But actually in Active Record, they launched this thing called strict loading. And what you can do is if you have spots in your code, either on like a particular line, or you can more globally set it for a whole model, I believe, you can say this should be strict loaded. And that actually prevents you from doing the lazy loading style, which is where you get this N+1 query pattern in the first place. So you can actually like, you can either do it in response to lazy loading causing these excessive queries, or you can even do it proactively, like up front. You can say, I'm writing this new code. It's going to be a strict loading line. And if you're like in a view or you're in a serializer and you're writing a loop and you try to lazy load something that's not already loaded, you have a chain methods and then you're calling some code, Active Record will raise an exception in the development process and it will say this is a strict loading model. And that's going to force you to say, oh, okay, I need to go and eager load this. And I think it's like provides you both the flexibility. Maybe you want lazy loading for some reason. Maybe your library code depends on it or something like that. But it also gives you the option to say, I definitely don't want this and I want to encode that pattern. And it also is communicative. It communicates like in the calling location, I don't want eager loading here. Maybe you could leave a little comment that says, we don't want to allow lazy loading here. So yeah, I think that's something I learned about. And I'm trying to also, like you, I also have worked on many a Rails upgrade and we're not really making great use of it. But I think both of those tools are things I've learned about in writing the book that I think are really valuable and I'd recommend for any Rails project.
Those are some good ones. Is there anything you desperately want to talk about before we wrap up the show?
Well, I did want to actually plug something I'm doing that's related to the book, but it doesn't involve anyone buying anything.
Okay.
Partly to shout out all of these open source projects and the maintainers, and really because I'm writing a book built on a lot of their work, I feel like it's the least I could do. But currently, if you go to pgrailsbook.com, at least for the next couple of weeks, I know the podcast might come out a different time or whatever, but they'll still be, even if it's later and you want to find out these things, just send me an email and I'll do my best to hook you up. But what I'm doing currently is I set up an email list and I have a landing page. So it's at pgrailsbook.com. If you subscribe, I'm sending out 4 emails in total, each with about 10 of the Ruby gems and extensions with brief summaries about them that are used in the book. So I thought it'd be like a little bit of a hook kind of to get people interested. Ultimately, the purpose of the subscriber list right now, the main purpose is just going to send one email when the book's out and say, hey, the book's out. But yeah. Maybe I'll keep it going. I'm not really sure yet. Yeah, again, loads and loads of open source projects. Really, there's a whole ecosystem around whether it's Postgres and Ruby on Rails or another application framework. So I think it's great to know about these tools and find out if they help solve your problems that you're facing.
I feel like as old as Rails is, I shouldn't be surprised by things anymore. But yeah, I feel like I'm constantly learning new tools and going, where has this been my whole career?
Yeah.
So I definitely appreciate something like that where you can kind of go and say, here's a vetted tool that is awesome and going to make your life better. So I appreciate that. So we'll definitely include in the show notes, but pgrailsbook.com is where to go to sign up for that bit of a newsletter and also to get updates on the book. It's going into the beta release on August 30th. So I'm super excited. Awesome. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about the book and getting me even more excited about it. I appreciate you taking time out of your day.
Thanks again for having me, Drew. And thanks for some great questions. And looking forward to staying in touch with you about these topics.
Speaking of staying in touch, outside of pgrailsbook.com, where can folks find you on the internet?
My personal blog is andyatkinson.com. I'm also on Twitter and Mastodon, and I just got a Blue Sky account, and I'm pretty sure there's like 10 people on Blue Sky, but it's I use the same handle. It's A-N-D-A-T-K-I.
Okay.
On each of those social media platforms. So feel free to hit me up. I also want to shout out the Postgres Slack community. If you do use Postgres, there is a Slack community. And if you use Slack at work, it's pretty nice to just have it open. You can pop in and there's DBAs and database experts that can help, whether it's schema design or query problems or that kind of thing. And it's a good community also. It's a friendly community.
Fantastic. Awesome. Thanks for all the great information and resources. And once the book is out and making its rounds, we'll have you back on to see how it all went.
Appreciate it. Thank you.